Today is Wednesday, December the 4th. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Hurricane storms Helene and Milton have destroyed whole communities in the southeastern United States. You can make a difference. There are still many people in recovery mode. You can play a vital role in helping those affected to recover and rebuild their lives. Your donations to the Red Cross will help deliver essential services and supplies to those in need. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how big tech companies and our government are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a 3-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.live, that's PRN.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your questions or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Lina Khan had signed off on an antitrust investigation of Microsoft. The Federal Trade Commission's chair, appointed by outgoing President Joe Biden, had signed off on an antitrust investigation of Microsoft. That's a big deal. Microsoft is the only one of the 5 big tech firms, also including Apple, Amazon, Meta Platform, and Alphabet, that has not faced a sweeping antitrust investigation in the past 4 years. Inquiries into the other 4 led to the U.S. government suing each, and it prevailed in the search case against Alphabet, while other cases are pending. Of course, Microsoft has already gone through an antitrust investigation and lawsuit back in the late 1990s when the U.S. government sued it for tying the sale of its software products to the use of its Windows operating system, which dominated then the personal computer market. Microsoft lost that case and in 2001 was prohibited from doing things that hurt rival software products. Over time, though, it rebuilt its reputation in Washington, partly thanks to its president, Brad Smith. Until today, Microsoft was seen as in a better position in Washington than its big tech peers. Things may not have been as rosy as they appeared, however. Bloomberg's report said the FTC had been interviewing rivals and business partners for more than a year, focusing on Microsoft's cloud computing, software licensing, cybersecurity offering, and AI products. That's a lot of territory. Earlier this year, the company stopped including its Teams feature, which competes with Slack and Zoom products, by default in its Office suite of software services after a European regulatory inquiry. At the time, Zoom's CEO, Eric Yuan, had called for the FTC to investigate the issue. More recently, Reuters reported that Alphabet had complained to European regulators about how Microsoft charged customers more to use its Windows Server software on rival cloud services than if customers used the software on its Azure cloud service. And a New York Times report in June found that the FTC was looking at Microsoft and OpenAI, the leading AI startup, backed by the software giant. The wild card in this investigation is that Khan only has a few weeks left. Microsoft has taken steps to buddy up to the incoming administration. You can imagine a scenario where Trump's nominee for the FTC kills the investigation before it gets too much further. For now, though, it's a whole new regulatory ball game for Microsoft. The Department of Justice and 16 state attorney generals want Disney-Fox cartel blocked. The Department of Justice and the 16 state attorney generals filed briefs, agreeing with a federal judge's decision to temporarily block the launch of a new streaming service combination of media giants Disney, Fox, and Warner Brothers Discovery. In February of this year, the three media players announced their plan to combine their key live sports assets, including Disney's ESPN, Fox's Fox Sports, and Warner Brothers Discovery TNT Sports. The new streaming service called Venue, that's V-E-N-U, would bundle the sports channels of the trio, forcing consumers who want their content to purchase a subscription at a price the cartel sets. Critics of the deal cried foul, saying the move would limit competition and increase pricing for consumers. The combination would give the Disney-Fox WBD sports cartel near dictatorial control over streaming services and perhaps cable TV systems, because such content is critical for their existence. In August of this year, U.S. District Judge Margaret M. Garnett in New York agreed with Fubo, a streaming service that filed a lawsuit against the partners of the new platform, Venue Sports, claiming that the service would involve violating federal antitrust laws. Venue was to have launched this fall, showing professional sports content from the National Football League, National Hockey League, the National Basketball Association, along with other sports content owned by the combination. The Sports Fan Coalition, reporting the briefs that have been filed, noted that it, the America Economic Liberties Project, Electronic Frontier Foundation, Open Markets Institute, and Public Knowledge filed an amicus brief supporting Fubo's lawsuit. The Venue sports partners have appealed the injunction, after which the American Antitrust Institute, the Center for Democracy and Technology, and the National Consumers League also joined with Fubo. The Department of Justice brief by Assistant Attorney General Jonathan Cantor and others from the Attorney General's office argues that Garnett's decision should be affirmed and said that Venue's argument that forcing large bundles on fans isn't anti-competitive. It's a red herring. This appeal is about a claim that defendants' creation of Venue, indisputably concerted action, violates Section 7 of the Clayton Act, the brief said. Section 7 purpose is to arrest incipient threats to competition, which the Sherman Act did not ordinarily reach. The brief further argues that Fubo would likely succeed in a trial against Venue. As the district court found, the current live pay TV market is highly competitive, with numerous distributors offering packages of television channels to consumers, Cantor wrote. Venue would lessen that current competition by giving defendants a path to collective dominance and foreclosing Venue's rivals. That is paradigmatic Section 7 harm. Meanwhile, the 16 state attorneys general focus on the claims made by the Venue partners, which they called erroneous, saying they have no duty to deal. The rules under duty to deal says companies with significant market power could be required to distribute products or services to competitors to maintain market competition while preventing anti-competitive behavior. Garnett ruled that this duty to deal defense was not valid, and the state attorneys general agreed, writing that the doctrine applies only to certain types of unilateral conduct challenged under Section 2 of the Sherman Act and does not apply to joint conduct like the launch of defendants' joint venture here. The attorneys general added that the district court properly rejected the defendants' defense, stating that they would violate Section 7 of the Clayton Act if it substantially lessens competition in the relevant market. The state attorneys general joining the brief were from the states of New York, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Illinois, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New Jersey, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Vermont, Washington, and Washington, D.C. On Monday, Intel announced that CEO Pat Gelsinger has resigned after a difficult stint at the company. The once dominant chipmaker stock cratered as it missed the AI boom and was surpassed by most of its rivals. Gelsinger took over as Intel's chief executive in February of 2021, returning to the company at which he worked for decades, including as chief technology officer. He had left Intel for a stint as CEO of software giant VMware. At Intel, Gelsinger was tasked with turning around the iconic American tech giant that was struggling against unprecedented competition, production delays, and the departure of top talent. But during his tenure, the company's prospect continued to decline as it became clear the company had fallen behind on another major technology wave. And despite billions of dollars in U.S. government spending to support its domestic chip manufacturing, Intel stock plunged 61% during Gelsinger's tenure. The stock rose 3% in early trading on Monday before dipping more than 1% by midday. The company announced in August that it would lay off 15% of its staff as part of its effort to slash $10 billion in costs and fundamentally change the way they operate, as Gelsinger said at the time. Intel once had a stranglehold on the world's computer chip market with Intel chips inside PCs and Macs, but the mobile computing wave of the past two decades caught the company off guard, leaving it to fall behind rivals. In recent years, Intel was caught on its back foot by the AI wave. The year after Gelsinger took over as CEO, OpenAI introduced ChatGPT, which took the world by storm. The rest is history. NVIDIA, which was once a tiny Intel competitor, is now the second most valuable company in the world after it bet big on chips that can power the massive data centers that power AI. NVIDIA's $3.4 trillion market value is 33 times bigger than Intel's $104 billion value. NVIDIA stock has surged nearly 720% over the past 2 years as the company became the talk of the tech world and one of the most valuable public companies in the world. Intel's struggle has raised questions about a potential takeover by a rival like Qualcomm, a possibility that may be more practical under the incoming Trump administration, which is expected to be less aggressive in pursuing antitrust concerns. Gelsinger stepped down as CEO and resigned from the Intel's board effective December the 1st, the company said on Monday. He will be replaced by interim co-CEOs David Zinsner, who is Intel's chief financial officer, and Michelle Johnston Holthaus, who's referred to as MJ. She's the general manager of Intel's client computing group as the company conducts a search for a permanent new CEO. Holthaus has also been named to the newly created CEO of Intel Products, which will oversee, among other things, its data center and AI product efforts. While we have made significant progress in regaining manufacturing competitiveness and building the capabilities to be a world-class foundry, we know that we have much more work to do at the company and are committed to restoring investor confidence. Frank Yeary, Intel's independent board chair, who had been named interim executive chair following Gelsinger's exit, said in a statement, "With Dave and MJ's leadership, we will continue to act with urgency on our priorities, simplifying and strengthening our product portfolio and advancing our manufacturing and foundry capabilities while optimizing our operating expenses and capital. We are working to create a leaner, simpler, more agile Intel," Yuri said. Intel's new co-CEOs will oversee a risky and expensive bid to transition the company's business model to manufacture processors for competitors like Apple, putting it into more direct competition with chip-making giant Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation. That effort has been central to a push by the Biden administration to revitalize chip manufacturing on American soil, but even that has been dogged by delays. Intel last week announced that the $8.5 billion grant it had been awarded by the Biden administration in March under the CHIPS Act to support the construction and expansion of U.S. manufacturing facilities was being cut to $7.86 billion after Intel delayed its timeline for investing in and opening some new plants. The company said the reduced award reflected a separate $3 billion award from the government to produce chips for U.S. defense efforts. Elon Musk plans to bring OpenAI competitor in market. XAI currently has a single main offering, Grok, which is a generative AI chatbot that the company claims will be a direct competitor to OpenAI's ChatGPT. Tesla and SpaceX founder and CEO Elon Musk is ramping up his activities in the artificial intelligence world via his xAI firm. Founded in July of 2023, xAI is heading towards the creation of AI that would be comparable to such titans as OpenAI, the company formed by Musk in 2015 and left in 2018 due to differences in the vision of the company's further development. xAI currently has a single main offering, Grok, G-R-O-K, which is a generative AI chatbot that the company claims will be a direct competitor to OpenAI's ChatGPT. X is added to Grok. With the help of Grok, you can interact with a conversational AI and have a sense of humor during the conversation. Grok also connects you with X. It was formerly Twitter, as everyone knows. First introduced to customers subscribed to X Premium, Grok has experienced a few developments to improve its functions. Specifically, in August of 2024, xAI launched Grok 2, which added some image generation functionality, and it can be compared to other new generations of AI, such as Google's Gemini and Anthropic's Claude. In expanding its capability, xAI aims to provide a separate consumer-facing application for Grok by the end of this year, at the earliest. This step is to expand Grok's reach to as many people as possible, which puts it head-on with OpenAI ChatGPT, which already has its app and free stuff. At present, only the members of X can explore Grok, but the new app is expected to offer a non-mediating interface. The xAI is building a new data center in Memphis, the size of which is to be called Colossus, for Grok's development. Their previous in-house GPU compute density was 4,000 NVIDIA A100 GPUs, but this new facility will hold 100,000 NVIDIA H100 GPUs, which would greatly expand the computational power of xAI. The project has enjoyed a lot of support, especially from the local authorities, who agreed that the project is one of the largest single investment in the city. In terms of funding, xAI has secured $11 billion in funding, which has lifted the company's valuation to $50 billion, though this ranks the company as the second largest private AI developer, only to OpenAI. Still, xAI has received this much funding, much of which comes from Musk's other companies, yet its revenue generation is significantly lower than OpenAI's estimated $4 billion for the same period. Therefore, to diversify its income, xAI has developed a developer tool for Grok and has also set out on the production of a standalone consumer version for Grok to appeal to a wider market population. xAI faces stiff competition from established AI developers such as OpenAI, Google, Meta, and Anthropic. Musk remains focused on surpassing OpenAI despite xAI still needing to refine its technology. The planned standalone app for Grok represents a strategic effort to compete more directly with these industry leaders by offering a comparable, if not superior, user experience. New Windows cyber attack warning as zero-click Russian backdoor confirmed. A cyber attack chaining two zero-day security vulnerabilities together, one with a severity rating of 9.8 and the other 8.8, has been confirmed by security researchers as being by a known Russian state-sponsored threat group called ROMCOM, that's R-O-M-C-O-M, after the malware family it exploits. The cyber attack using these previously unknown security vulnerabilities exploited both the Mozilla Firefox web browser and Windows itself in order to install a backdoor capable of executing commands and downloading further malware onto the target computer. Here's what we know about ROMCOM attack against Windows users. With potential victims primarily located in Europe and North America, security researchers from ESET have published a detailed analysis of what they refer to as being a widespread campaign. To get an idea of how big a deal this cyber attack was, it involved the use of not one, but two zero-day vulnerabilities chained together in a powerful exploit that could end up installing a Russian hacker-controlled backdoor on Windows computers. The Mozilla vulnerability CVE-2024-9680 with an extremely high common vulnerabilities and exposures risk severity rating of 9.8 out of 10 was a use after free memory flaw in the Firefox animation timeline feature. Meanwhile, the Windows Zero Day CVE-2024-49039 rated at 8.8 out of 10 was a privilege of escalation flaw that could enable malicious code to operate outside of the Mozilla Firefox browser security sandbox. Chaining these together in what was called a zero-click exploit is about as close to a 10 out of 10 danger rating itself. The compromise chain is composed of a fake website that redirects the potential victim to a server hosting the exploit, and should the exploit succeed, shellcode is executed that downloads and executes the ROMCOM backdoor. Astronauts unpack cargo, Russian spacecraft, and discovered a foul odor. The Progress 90 cargo ship carried nearly 3 tons of food, fuel, and supplies to the International Space Station. The Progress 90 cargo ship arrived at the ISS with 3 tons of supplies and a stinky odor. The hatch between a Russian cargo ship and the International Space Station is finally open after a foul stench initially prompted astronauts to seal it off. The good news is the smell has not lingered and NASA may have figured out the cause. Roscosmos cosmonauts Ivan Wagner and Alexander Gorbunov unpacked the Progress 90 cargo ship, which carried 3 tons of food, fuel, and other supplies to the ISS, and upon docking to the space station's PIOSC module on Saturday, astronauts noted a weird smell coming from the cargo ship. In addition to some odd floating droplets, after keeping the hatch that connected Progress and the Russian module closed to seal off the stench, the astronauts later reported that the odor dissipated quickly and they proceeded with cargo transfer operations. As for the reasons behind the odd smell, Google said it may have been due to outgassing from the materials inside the cargo spacecraft. It's not clear whether that may have affected the supplies being loaded onto the ISS. Upon the detection of the smell, the flight controllers on the ground activated air scrubbing equipment as part of normal procedures. Cosmonaut Wagner also cleaned the ventilation systems and conducted photography inspections, according to the space agency. NASA had reported earlier that the air quality inside the space station was at normal levels, dismissing concerns that the ISS may have been exposed to a contamination risk. The Progress 90 spacecraft is set to remain docked to the ISS for a period of 6 months. Afterwards, the cargo ship will plunge towards Earth's atmosphere, burning up upon re-entry, along with trash from the ISS that the astronauts will load onto Progress. By the way, this foul odor, might it be possibly someone passed gas? Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and everything in between. A buddy of mine, Oscar, reached out to me, and he was struggling with his resume. He was coming into a situation where he felt like he was not getting enough attention to all of these different applications he was putting out. And he forwarded his resume over to me, and this is where we start to get into more of that technology field where we are so tempted to dive in. We're so tempted to look at different options that we kind of forget what they are. I looked his resume over, and as I'm going through, I realized that there were a number of empty terms that were being used in this resume, and these different terms were kind of generic. And I said, "Oscar, who wrote your resume for you?" He said, "ChatGPT." and then I knew the problem, or at least one potential problem. His resume was filled with a lot of AI-generated emptiness. It did not capture the soul of who he was. It really came across as a robotic speech about the job he wanted, the job he was seeking, the various directions that he wanted to go in, but without capturing what was really individualistic about him, that key component that we all need to set ourselves apart from others. The latest statistics out there say that there are probably around 25% of the resumes that are out there that are being generated by nothing more than artificial intelligence. And if you're going to go to ChatGPT, if you're going to go to Microsoft Copilot or any of these different AI platforms and you're going to seek for them to generate your resume, you're going to find your resume does not look different from those others, but very close to those others that are generated out there. That's rough. That is disturbing when you're trying to get a role based on you. So what is the secret here? What is the key thing that we all need to be paying attention to? And that is that ChatGPT, artificial intelligence, whatever its form is, needs to be double-checked, triple-checked. You need to use ChatGPT if you're using it for anything, much like the line from Pirates of the Caribbean, the first movie, more as a, not so much as a rule, but as a guideline. You need to have it set up your framework. You need to use it to give you ideas. But really, you need to be, as a human, going through every single word that it puts out. You need to make sure that it's not copying anything that you've put into it, or and treating that response that you get out of it as golden. It's not silver. It's barely even bronze. So what do we need to do here? Watch for those buzz terms. A lot of those different buzz terms, that the buzz phrases, buzz words that you're using need to be backed up with real examples. They need to dive deep into how that works. Okay, so if you call yourself a team player, you need to explain why you're a team player, how you're a team player, what benefit that brings with you to the job. This idea of cutting and pasting and just dropping it in isn't going to work. You need to pay attention to everything there. You need to make sure that your sentence structures, your bullet points, your everything is words out of your own mouth. If you typically communicate on a certain level and all of a sudden you're sitting there, you're going, oh, ChatGPT makes me sound so much smarter, that may be a sign for you. I've never heard of this buzzword before. Maybe you need to think about pulling that out. You need to be going through every single bit of this, and you need to be thinking about how you're approaching it. Anything you're doing with artificial intelligence should be a starting point. It should be your first run at this, a first draft. But then you need to go over it again and again and again. You need to make your resume not so much of a rehash of what the job posting was, but personalized. Everything about it should be talking about you and how you are different from the others. Everything you should be putting into whatever you're putting out, whether it's a resume, whether it's a new article, a new document that you're doing, it should look like you put every word on that page, not some faceless automaton that barely understands the real world. You need to stand out as a human being that has brains, blood coursing through the veins, and a passion for that job. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Windows 11 Release 24H2 Update has compatibility issues for USB printers and scanners. Microsoft has acknowledged several compatibility issues that are affecting USB-connected printers and scanners. Microsoft has temporarily halted the distribution of the 24H2 update to users who own affected hardware. Despite collaborative efforts between Microsoft and various device manufacturers to identify and address the root causes of these issues, initial driver updates have not fully resolved the problems. The primary technical issues involve devices that utilizes the ESCL protocol, a communication standard implemented by major manufacturers such as HP, Brother, and Fujitsu. The ESCL protocol is critical for enabling effective communication between scanning devices and computers, facilitating essential functions like device recognition, data transfer, and command execution. However, following the installation of the Windows 11 24H2 update, many users have reported that their systems fail to recognize connected scanning devices, rendering them inoperative. This problem extends beyond standalone scanners to include the USB-dependent peripherals such as fax machines and modems, indicating a broader scope of the compatibility issues introduced by the update. The underlying cause appears to be conflicts between the new system drivers included in the 24H2 update and the existing drivers required for the proper functioning of the ESCL protocol. These conflicts disrupt the necessary communication pathways, preventing devices from operating as intended. To mitigate these disruptions, Microsoft currently advises users to postpone the installation of the Windows 11 24H2 update until a comprehensive solution is available. For those who have already installed the update and are experiencing issues with their USB-connected devices, the recommended course of action is to revert to a previous version of Windows 11. This rollback process involves navigating to the system settings, accessing the recovery options, and selecting an earlier system restore point prior to the installation of the 24H2 update. While reverting to an earlier version is a temporary measure and may not resolve all related issues, it remains the most effective option to restore device functionality until Microsoft releases an official patch to address the compatibility problems. Additionally, users are encouraged to regularly check for updates from both Microsoft and the device manufacturers, as these may contain fixes or workarounds for the identified issues. Googling is for old people. Well, that's a problem for Google. The trends moving against Google are so numerous and interrelated that the Justice Department's attempt to dismantle the company, the specific which was unveiled November the 20th, could be the least of its problems. The company's core business is under siege. People are increasingly getting answers from artificial intelligence. Younger generations are using other platforms to gather information. And the quality of the results delivered by a search engine is deteriorating as the web is flooded with AI-generated content. Taken together, these forces could lead to long-term decline in Google search traffic and the outsized profits generated from it, which prop up its parent company Alphabet's money-losing bets on things like Waymo's self-driving unit. The first danger facing Google is clear and present. When people want to search for information or go shopping on the internet, they are shifting to Google's competitors, and advertising dollars are following them. In 2025, eMarketer projects Google's share of the U.S. search advertising market will fall below 50% for the first time since the company began tracking it. In responding to government's antitrust inquiries, Google itself makes this point often. Evidence at trial shows we face fierce competition from a broad range of competitors. This shift is due largely to users bypassing Google to start their search for goods on Amazon. It's handing Amazon's billions in advertiser dollars. Meanwhile, TikTok has less than 4% of the U.S. digital ad revenue, but significant potential to expand its share of the pie. A recent TikTok pitch to advertisers reported by the Wall Street Journal said that 23% of the users search for something within 30 seconds of opening the app, and its global search volume was 3 billion a day. The second threat is the rise of answer engines like Perplexity, which, well, do what they say on the tin. OpenAI has added internet search to ChatGPT, Meta Platforms is exploring building its own search engine, and even AI chatbots that can't search the internet are proving increasingly capable at addressing many questions. They're also becoming ever more widespread as Microsoft and Apple integrate them directly into the operating system of all the devices they make or support. Google had this seemingly insurmountable position in search until AI came around. And now AI is to search what e-commerce was to Walmart, says Melissa Schilling, a professor of management at New York University's Stern School of Business. Another comparable moment was when Microsoft missed the importance of the smartphone and the iPhone upended its dominance of consumer computing, she adds. Of course, Google is hard at work trying to make sure that if anyone is going to disrupt the search paradigm with AI, it's Google itself. Earlier this year, Google rolled out AI summaries of its own search results to all users in the United States. The company had said that such innovation is in direct response to intense competition from AI at both startups and tech giants. The third trend that threatens Google is one the company may not be able to do much about, and that makes it most dangerous: the degradation of the overall ecosystem of websites that Google has shaped on which it depends. Chromebook versus a PC or Mac laptop. What you can and cannot do with a Chromebook. Chromebooks are a tempting option for the budget conscious, especially if you're looking for a new computer that you can easily take on the go. The main thing is to keep in mind when comparing a laptop to a Chromebook is that it is not a one-to-one direct comparison. The main difference, besides price, is the operating system. If you're currently using Windows or Mac OS, Google's Chrome operating system may not have all the functionality you need, but then again, maybe it does. When Chromebooks were first introduced in 2011, they were routinely dismissed for their limited functionality and its reliance on a consistent internet connection. The operating system is now more than a decade old, and today's Chromebooks, which come in both laptop and two-in-one designs, are far from where they started. Still, some things haven't changed, and you might not be willing to work with the limitations they do have. When Chrome OS launched, it was essentially Google Chrome web browser. For those used to using an operating system like Windows and Mac, it made the average Chromebook seem pedestrian. However, quite a lot can be done entirely on the web these days. Take stock of everything you do on a daily basis, and you may find there's nothing you can't accomplish with Chrome OS at its most basic level. Chromebooks are not natively compatible with Windows or Mac software. However, the Google Play Store has a whole world of Android apps, and many websites are available as progressive web apps. Also, if you're considering a Chromebook as a secondary device, you can use Windows or Mac software on a Chromebook by using Chrome's remote desktop feature. One of the big hurdles here for many people is access to Microsoft Office. You cannot install the full Windows or Mac OS desktop versions of Office software on a Chromebook. But you can use Office 365 Online and install the Office Progressive Web Apps. Progressive Web Apps act just like mobile apps, so you can use them offline. use notifications, and pin them to the taskbar. But, generally speaking, if you want a specific Windows or Mac application, and there's no suitable web or Android app substitute, don't get a Chromebook. Also, if you need advanced photo and video editing capabilities to use locally on the laptop, you'll want Windows, Mac, or Linux laptop. There are multiple cloud-based and mobile app options available for photo and video editing, including Adobe Tools, so it's possible to do some pro-level editing on the Chromebook. And Google's own photo app also has some strong editing capabilities. But you won't have the option to install Windows or Mac software or the performance for complex rendering tasks. You'll run into a similar issue with gaming. With streaming game services like NVIDIA GeForce Now, Amazon Luna, and Xbox Cloud Gaming, Chromebooks can play more than Android and browser-based games. There are now tools built into Chrome OS to make gaming more fun, and even gaming Chromebooks with faster 120Hz displays and RGB lighting. But if PC gaming is your goal, an entry-level Windows gaming laptop is a better starting point. Well, what is a good Chromebook? Now, there's a far greater variety of laptops and 2-in-1s, convertibles, and tablets. If you're just after a good basic experience with a Chromebook, the small lightweight OS has minimal hardware requirements, having a faster, higher-end processor, more memory, and greater storage for files and apps will help keep demanding multitaskers moving along. An Intel Core Series or AMD Ryzen processor, 8 GB of memory, and a 128 GB solid-state drive for storage will take you far. However, there's a new category of devices called Chromebook Plus. These models have a basic standard of specs, so you're guaranteed a higher level of performance and features regardless of price. Regardless of what Chromebooks you buy, before you buy it, you should find out the device auto update expiration date, or the AUE. Currently, non-Google hardware is only supported for so long before it stops receiving Chrome OS and browser updates, including those for security. Chromebooks now receive 10 years of automatic updates from the initial release of the device. Models released prior to 2021 were generally good for 7 or 8 years. But some features and services might not be supported. Google maintains a list of AUE dates for all models, and you should check it before you buy a Chromebook, new or used. When Chromebooks were first launched, they basically became paperweights when they were offline, a real issue if you were in the middle of editing an important document and you suddenly couldn't save your work because your web connection dropped. That, thankfully, no longer is the case, as Google improved offline capabilities and common apps like Netflix, YouTube, and Spotify have offline options as well. For a regular laptop, being offline is a little less of a problem since you're more typically using installed software that saves the internal storage. Chromebooks are not a great choice if you're not willing and able to be online most of the time. On the upside, Google has made it very easy for Android users to turn their phones into instant mobile hotspots and to have Chromebooks and Android devices work better together. Because Chrome OS has lower hardware requirements, Chromebooks can be lighter, smaller, and last longer than the average laptop. They're also generally less expensive. With Windows laptops, you typically need to spend about $700 or more to get a thin, lightweight model with a decent performance and battery life that will hold its performance for years to come. The same goes for MacBooks. The simplicity of a Chromebook can't be beat, however. If everything you can do be done in a web browser or with a web or Android apps, there's little reason not to go with a Chrome OS device. Just for the record, to let you know, I have 3 Chromebooks at home, and I also have Windows operating PCs also. One size does not fit all my requirements. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston joins me now, and Marty, wait, you just say, ask me about magnets. What's going on here?
Oh, man. You know, it's really amazing how many people, even product designers, don't understand magnetism. They don't even understand animal magnetism. They think it means you can stick your cat on a fridge. But this...
Mine crawls on top of the fridge all the time, but okay, all right.
Yeah, but never sticks in one place. You'll notice that
No, she doesn't.
And they may stick to a bowl full of food, but that's catnip.
Yes.
Anyway, this isn't a game of cat and mouse. More like cat... No, fat and gauss.
Okay.
Okay, because I'd better explain it. A while back, when I first got my new Google Pixel 9 Pro XL phone, you'll remember, I got in a case from a company that isn't Otter.
Okay, and, yes.
Right? You know the old saying, when it comes to cases, there's OtterBox and then there's everybody else.
Uh-huh.
Well, that company loved the trendy static magnets that let you stick your phone onto other magnets to hold it. And
Sure.
Right? They built their case with all of that as an apparent priority.
Mm-hmm. Well, I seem to recall it also meant because of the thickness of the case, you couldn't charge it using Qi technology?
Yeah. You are correct, sir.
Okay. All right. Go on. I was searching the recesses of my mind here.
No, well, there's a lot of recesses because it's a big mind.
Yes. Thank you.
Yes. It's the best I could do. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, your car's listening to this. Stop laughing. Anyway, it was good for letting you stick your phone onto another magnet to hold it. But, you know, I needed it. Well, at least I wanted a case that I could magnetically charge, as you said.
Yeah,
right. Well, that takes a changing magnetic field. For those of you who want to visualize this as an animation, instead of going, the magnetic field has to go, wooba, 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 wooba.
Okay.
At much higher speeds than illustrated here. That changing magnetic field is the basis of radio and so many other things. That kind of changing magnetic field makes motors move, lets generators generate, right?
Yeah.
And that other case was very picky about ever letting that happen, even if you got it precisely within a millimeter or 2 millimeters precisely positioned.
Yeah.
It would show a charge for about 1 second and then stop.
Frustrating.
Oh, at least. Yes. Now, look, that other case didn't bother putting a flap over the USB connector, which is just as well because you were always plugging a charging cord in there.
Yeah.
Anyway, enough of the other case. I asked Otter for a Defender, and they came through.
Mm-hmm.
Let me say, no matter how many times I've dropped any of my phones, I've never had a case or a screen crack when the phone was in an OtterBox Defender case.
Yeah, OtterBox makes some very nice cases. My work phone. I have two phones. I've got my personal phone and I've got a work phone, and the work phone is in an OtterBox, and it will take whatever beating I give it, I'm sure.
Well, don't spank it and don't throw it down, but you're right. It's going to come back no matter what.
Yeah.
So the OtterBox, by the way, does have that little rubber flap over the USB-C port to keep water from going in that way. Mm-hmm. And also, let me say, it does let me cordlessly recharge for as long as I want to keep it on the charger.
Yes, it does, yeah.
And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it, of the OtterBox Defender that to this moment is going to be the permanent wrap for my new phone.
Yeah. I understand completely. So you've dealt with OtterBoxes for how long? Since they first came out, probably.
Dawn of time, when the Otter was barely a pup. I was right there. You know, mentioning that USB-C port made me think of something else. I'm getting some boards in to test and figure out, and they don't always come with specs.
Okay, yeah.
And I reached into my toolkit, my what is this drawer, And I brought out my Klein Tools, multimeter for USB power feeds. Whoop, just hit the floor. Didn't need the outer box.
Yes, it did. I was thinking the same thing. So what all does that do?
Well, what it told me was the board I was testing was normal 5 volts and pretty close to that USB power and drawing just under 500 milliamps.
Okay.
Now, that had some consequence because I had designed a product that was delivering 12 volts. And all of a sudden, because a part ended up lying to me and I had to replace it, I needed 5.
Yeah.
And when I'll tell you the story a little later. I'll tell everybody the story. We found a way to move from analog to a microcontroller for 35 cents. And that meant I had to add 5 volts, and I had no idea how much this took, and it would have made a $14 difference in my cost if it took more than about an amp, took less than half. Hurrah. And thank you, Klein Tools. Thank you, OtterBox. Thank you, Benjamin.
Very cool. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, December the 5th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. and the presentation is Holiday Tech Gift Ideas. It's a hybrid meeting. Meeting at the Scarsdale Public Library, located at 54 Olmsted Road, Scarsdale, New York, and online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is wpcug.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, December the 6th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. The King's Byte Computer Club meets Tuesday, December 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Meeting at the Park Plaza Restaurant, located at 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. For more information, 347-278-7320. The New York Amateur Computer Club meets Thursday, December the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. It is a hybrid meeting. Meeting at Studios 353, located at 353 West 48th Street. If you plan to attend the meeting, you must first register via the website nyacc.org for confirmation. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, December the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Zoom. And the website is limac.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to Hank at pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.